Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
I need to lose weight. Diet. Deprivation. Misery. Ugh.
What if you could lose weight without feeling awful? R3 Weight Loss by Susan Torberg is the real food plan you've been dreaming about. No calorie counting or journaling. A doable plan for real life. With R3 Weight Loss, you'll break those sugar and carb cravings but still be able to eat things you love, teaching you discipline and managing your weight for life. Visit r3weightlossplan.com. $39 will change your life.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio on your dial. Glad you could join us tonight. Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meets. Every Monday evening between 10 and 11 p.m. on WCAP Radio 980 AM. And also streaming live across the universe. Beneath the Surface, bringing a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. Well, 1 week before Christmas Eve, and my special guest tonight on Beneath the Surface, there he is, your favorite guest and mine, Mr. Kent Niebuhr.
Hi.
You guessed the right mic.
Did I guess the right mic?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, great. So here's, you just introduced me as your special guest, and I'm wondering, I've been doing this radio show for a very long time, I think, and I'm wondering what it would take to be a non-special guest.
Well, a non-special guest, you would have to be unspecial.
Oh, okay. So it's not that, yeah. It's not my guestness that is special, it's myself that is special.
Yes.
There is no non-special guest.
All right, what did she say?
I have no idea what she said. I have no cans tonight. I don't have headphones tonight.
I said there's no such thing as a non-special guest.
There's no such thing as a non-special guest.
All right, perfect. Yeah. So then it's redundant to say my special guest.
Redundant it is. Now, we are yakking away at each other right now because I'm kind of testing these headphones.
And it's a talk show.
So
yeah.
We have to yak.
Right.
But these headphones are so bad, I think I'm going to take them off and not use them.
Wow, we're both going to be Psalms headphones?
It's like nothing but distortion. So, Cindy, you deal with all the volume. I don't know how loud and soft things will be, but here we go.
Yeah. Now,
when
you talk about our radio show as being nothing but distortion,
yes,
how far does that go? How do we apply that?
I don't know what you're talking about, but that's okay. I very rarely do.
I have another question.
Oh, yes, Mr. Kent.
I'm asking all the questions.
You are.
Okay, I'm just picking over.
Well, this is our pre-show jibber-jabber, so go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So you always mention in the introduction that we try to bring a little sanity to the age of insanity. And I thought to myself, you know, what about the people out there who don't think that the world is insane right now? But then I thought to myself,
doesn't matter.
I'll bet that everybody does. I'll bet everybody in the world thinks there's something wrong with the world, and it needs fixing.
Oh, well, I think people think that there's, you know, things wrong with the world.
I'm changing mics.
You're changing mics now?
Yeah.
Yeah, you look better on that mic.
Wait, thank you.
Yeah, that fits you well.
It's got one of the WCA key. What do we...
Yeah, the microphone, it goes good with your sweater.
Hey, thanks.
Yeah,
yeah, you're right, it does.
Right,
look at that. We're letting Cindy do
it. So anyway,
I think
most people do believe that there's something wrong with this part of the world or that part of the world. But
they disagree on what it is.
But I don't think many people, as Cindy squirms and tries to figure out the headphones.
Cindy's doing a great job. She's like a firefighter.
I don't think most people would go so far as to say that we have entered the age of insanity. And that has been my thing for the past few months.
Okay.
I've been putting that on Facebook, that we have entered the era of insanity. I think history books will look back and see that we were in the, you know, they call things antiquity, you know, the Dark Ages, the medieval times, the modern era, and I think we have entered the age, the era of insanity. That's what it'll be looked at.
I don't know if I completely agree with you, but I sure can play along because I'm not really disagreeing with you. But what would it take if this is the era of insanity,
yes,
what would it take for there to be some point in the future where the general population looked back and said, wow,
yes,
this era, this 20th century, 21st century, they were absolutely insane.
Well, I think that's
how do we get from here to there?
In fact, there's only two options. Either we get there or we destroy ourselves.
Yeah, right.
Or you know, Christ comes back again and the end of the world occurs.
Wow.
But what will it take? It'll take first thing it takes is humility.
Yeah, so how do you get from an era of insanity? Let's say we're all insane, or I don't think you'd say we're all insane. Some of us are sane and some of us are not, insanity is relatively prevalent.
What I mean by this, I never point fingers at any particular persons. I'm just saying it's an era that is now clouded with insanity. And insanity basically means a non-rational or an irrational era that has taken a culture that has lost its mind and has been living a culture of death without really caring about it much.
Yeah.
And that's where we've been in the past half century.
Slouching all the way to, what was that phrase? Slouching all the way to tomorrow.
My take on this, very generally, is that you had, I will propose to you that the world has had three basic eras, notwithstanding all of those ages that we talked about a little earlier. One, I believe, from my perspective, is the pre-Christian era.
Mm-hmm.
One is the Christian era, and one is the post-Christian era.
Mm-hmm.
The pre-Christian era was sane, even though they didn't have the truth or the fullness of the truth, but they anticipated it.
Yeah.
And they waited for it, and they knew it was out there, and they sought it. And that's what all the great philosophers were doing.
They were seeking truth, objective reality.
Objective reality, seeking being, trying to understand being, trying to understand truth, trying to understand our true objective role in this universe. Socrates, Aristotle, Plato, on down the line. And there was an anticipatory kind of feel in the world at that time that truth is out there. We just need to find it.
And we're going to get there.
Now, you know, as a Catholic Christian, my understanding of history is that Christ is the center of it. And when he was incarnated, and we're going to be talking about that during the show, when he was incarnated, the Christian era began. And truth himself, the Logos in Greek, became enfleshed and dwelt among us. And his influence on the world, his positive influence, I think, was what all of those great philosophers and poets and truth seekers were seeking all the way up from the first human beings until that point. And so they found it. And if you ever read Peter Kreef's book, Socrates Meets Jesus, you'll see a good paperback, entertaining, dialogical version of this, that Socrates meets Jesus and says, wow, everything I've been seeking is found in you.
Right, right. But, and here's something that
I
wanted to
just,
point.
Can I just finish the loop?
Go ahead.
It'll only be a sentence or two.
Yep.
I think relatively recently we have entered the age of post-Christianity. And post-Christianity has no more anticipatory value to it. It's not anticipating the truth because the world had the truth, at least the Western world and much of the rest of it, and has rejected him, rejected it. No longer is that hope or anticipation that our answers and our heart's longings will be fulfilled or, in any way. And this is why the Western world today, one nation after another, is committing suicide with demographic implosion and just allowing illegal immigration galore, and doesn't care anymore. There seems to be a lack of hope. And because of this lack of hope for any answers to objective truth, we've thrown out even the notion of objective truth. And hence, reason has no reason to be around anymore. And of course, this is the era of progressivism, which is the era of insanity, to just live by feelings and desires and call all of our desires alternative lifestyles, and we are
choices
going underneath and we are dissipating as a culture and as a race relatively rapidly.
Okay, I want to point this out.
I'm all ears.
I do agree that if you look at Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, even a lot of the pre-Socratic philosophers, that there was that sense of anticipation.
Yes.
However, what I'm going to say is they were a small slice of the civilization. Don't forget, they killed Socrates.
I'm not saying that all people were good and, you know, fully truth-seeking philosophers and good at heart.
But you called it an era of...
I do believe the cultural fabric, the cultural milieu before Christ was anticipatory. I do believe people believed that there was objective truth and answers to questions. They just didn't know how to get to them.
Yeah, they didn't have enough material. They didn't have enough to go on. And I would say that they also, you know, there was a sense of morality, right? Which is, and what you find in the ancient world, and even persisting in the medieval era, is that they so believed in right and wrong that whenever they encountered wrong, they came down on it extremely harshly. I mean, the types of crimes you could commit that were capital crimes that got the death sentence were just mind-boggling in the ancient world.
Now,
so they definitely had the sense that there was right and wrong, and you had to purge evil, let's say, from your midst.
Now, if I could make another simplistic generality, I would say that the pre-Christian era was hate the sinner and hate the sin. The Christian era was love the sinner and hate the sin.
Right.
And our post-Christian era is love the sinner and love the sin.
Right. That's a good...
And I think that's one way to summarize it.
Yeah, right.
And that's where we're at now. We are loving the sin because there's no such thing as sin anymore in people's minds.
Yeah.
That's because we defined the left, the progressive left that has taken over the mainstream culture, is in its attempts to redefine reality.
Yeah, and I'm glad you used the word reality, because earlier you were using the word reason. And, you know, Pope Benedict XVI made a very good point about reason at one point. He said, prove reason is reasonable, where, you know, you kind of have to, you can only work internally. So when I think of this, I tend to think more in terms of reality. What is actually real? What is that?
Well, human reason is able to detect and discern what is real.
Yeah, it's an attempt to take reality and
make it intelligible.
Make it
so
intelligible
that we can understand
to convert it into language, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that other things do this too, like mathematics. Mathematics is just this awesome tool for making the physical universe intelligible.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Whereas reason goes beyond that and tries to make the immaterial metaphysics.
Reason and logic have a lot in common with mathematics.
Exactly. Yeah. And a lot of times these sciences have been many attempts to kind of merge them, right?
Well, they're all related.
Yeah. Because of the commonality of reality.
And the commonality of all of their ends, which is truth.
Truth.
Objective
right.
truth.
They're both working towards truth and many other disciplines. However, what math loses sight of is the immaterial aspect of reality, the metaphysical aspect of reality. For instance, in humans, that we have a soul.
Well, I think mathematics is very abstract and immaterial.
Right, but it doesn't. But it's still trying to get at the physical,
material.
The object
right.
of mathematics. What mathematics is studying is the physical
that's
universe.
That's why math and physics are you know, linked.
They're
yeah.
hand in hand. Right.
right.
So the question is, how is it now that we have such a mathematical, let's say, or scientific grasp on so much of the of physical existence that never before in human history have we even come close to? And yet we're so deficient in metaphysics. We're so deficient in understanding the human soul.
I disagree, and I think the answer is simple. I disagree in as much as I don't think we've all made humongous strides in physics compared to what we could and should know. We're still just trying to trying to chip away at the tip of the iceberg. However, I think the answer to your question is that we have become philosophical materialists, and that's why we don't care about reason
anymore.
Which is
what? What's a philosophical materialist?
A philosophical materialist means that one's philosophy of life includes only a reality that is material, that is concrete, that is physical.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so there's no opening in one's mind or heart of any reality that transcends the physical. That's a philosophy that's prevalent today.
I would take issue with that slightly because our metaphysics, our belief in what is not physical, not material, how we go beyond materialism, in other words, is into the emotional. So we
what are you talking about today?
Yes.
Today. Oh, okay. You mean the movement that's going on right now?
Right. What we today is materialism and emotionalism.
Yes.
Whereas we don't have objectivism so much. We don't have a grasp, not objectivism in the sense of like.
If you hold that there is an objective truth independent of us,
right?
Independent of our senses, of our psyche, that needs to be discovered, that means that we're not the creators of reality.
Yeah, exactly.
And that goes against post-Christian progressive thought.
Right. Basically. So another way to put what you're saying, I think, is once God is out of the picture, or you only pay lip service to God, so to speak, whereas you're not looking to God as being the author of your existence, the judge of your existence, the one who determines right and wrong for all of us.
And gives meaning to everything.
Meaning to everything. And who created the standard, who designed the universe and us as humanity with a certain norm, with a certain standard, a certain, let's say, an owner's manual, right?
Yeah, and so you can call it a natural order.
Natural law, right?
Right.
Once we abandon that, and God is nothing more than, like you mentioned Peter Crave. Peter Crave says, not so much our Father who art in heaven, but our grandpa who art in heaven, who just spoils us, who gives us whatever we want. He comes over every once in a while when we want him to. He gives us candy or money or toys or whatever we want, and then he goes away, and we get to enjoy our stuff. So, but the Father, and this is, I'm getting this from Peter Crave, the Father is the disciplinarian, right?
Yeah.
I'm talking in historical or
he forms you, he teaches you, and
he punishes you,
and he disciplines you.
He says no, and he says yes, and he says stop and go, and all
he's
of this.
The arbiter of life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Once you erase that kind of a God from existence, then what's left? All that's left is materialism and what makes me feel good.
Yeah, and in that you're your ultimate authority.
Right, because if all that's left is materialism and emotionalism, then what you're saying is what makes me feel good is good, and what makes me feel bad is bad. So if you have a father who looks at you and says no, that makes you feel bad, so therefore your father must be bad, and then you rebel against your father, and you...
Yeah, we're really going through an adolescent rebellion stage.
Yeah, it seems like civilization is being very adolescent.
In the era of insanity.
Now, I will say this. I have several adolescents at home, and they're very good adolescents.
Oh, good for you.
Thank God.
You lucked
out. I mean, not that they're perfect, not that they're absolute angels, but... they're pretty reasonable adolescents, I have to say.
That is fantastic.
Yeah,
you're blessed.
I still have parenting to do, but they're pretty awesome kids.
But anyway, this was an interesting introduction because in it we talked about the philosophy of materialism, and our show tonight, believe it or not, 15 minutes into it, actually more than that. 20 minutes into it.
Good night, ladies and gentlemen.
Is entitled A Charlie Brown Christmas.
Yeah.
We were going to come in here and talk about A Charlie Brown Christmas. What can Charlie, Linus, and the entire Peanuts gang teach us about Christmas?
Or Linus, Cletus, Clement.
Now, basically, there are three perhaps main points of a Charlie Brown Christmas that we could talk about tonight.
All right.
One is Charlie Brown's despair over materialism.
Yeah.
That it's totally taken over Christmas.
Charlie's the underdog hero.
He's totally despondent, you know, doesn't anybody know the meaning of Christmas? We'll talk about that. The Charlie Brown Christmas tree and what that signifies. It was just a little tiny skeleton, an ugly skeleton of a tree.
Yeah.
And then with little love, it blossomed. And then the third thing we could talk about with this Charlie Brown Christmas is Linus's recitation speech of the Gospel of Luke when he was on stage.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, that was the highlight of the show.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about those three things, and maybe we'll get into some of the other regular Christmas shows that we grew up with and that are still around today.
And then we're going to go caroling.
There's Christmas. There's Rudolph. There's Frosty the Snowman. And there's the Grinch. All of those things, if we have time, we'll talk about. But why don't we start, Kent, with this idea of Charlie Brown looking around. By the way, why does everybody always call him, even talking to his face, both of his names?
Yeah.
I always wondered about that.
Yeah, you know.
Charlie Brown, this Charlie Brown, I mean.
Why is he never?
Well, why isn't he just Charlie?
Peppermint Patty calls him?
Chuck. Very good point.
Right.
But everybody else calls him both of them. It's like me calling you Kent Niebuhr.
Yeah.
What are you doing now?
Yeah.
Kent Niebuhr, thanks for coming.
Right.
Like
I would think that was a tick or something that you had.
But everybody calls him Charlie Brown. Nobody calls him Charlie.
And you know what?
One person called him Charlie.
How many people call the show Peanuts? Mm. Most of all, we always refer to it as Charlie Brown.
Yeah, what the heck is Peanuts? Where did that come from?
That was the name of the cartoon series, Charles Schultz.
But what do Peanuts have to do with that?
Because little kids are sometimes referred to as Peanuts.
Okay, I'll buy that.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, but anyway.
They're never referred to as cashews. Have you noticed that?
You listening at home or in the car or wherever in the world you are, if you'd like to join us in our conversation tonight as we go beneath the surface on a Charlie Brown Christmas, our phone number is 978-454-4980. That's 978-454-4980. All right,
I want to tell the listeners that Paul has that phone number memorized.
I have memorized. Yeah, after
he's not looking at it. There are no cue cards.
Let's see. After 6 years. okay. You want to say, okay, Cindy wants to take a break.
Okay.
See, I will tell the people at home something that they may have already known if they listened to the beginning of this. We have no headphones on today. We're headphoneless. So we don't even know when the music comes on. So Cindy has to let us know through the glass. So she's letting me know we need to take a break. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. And I can't wait to get started in our show, Kent, right after this break.
Pretty soon. In the gift we deliver, in the gift we receive, is the living spirit Mary did conceive, the royal gift of loving and love. Here we go. Is given to all mankind in his name.
978-454-4980 is our phone number beneath the surface here at WCAP. Glad you could join us here until 11 p.m. And again, bringing a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. And today, ladies and gentle things, we're talking about a Charlie Brown Christmas and some of its messages. I believe this was created like most of the other great Christmas specials, right in the mid-60s, early to mid-60s. And it's just withstood the test of time amazingly.
Yeah, no doubt.
But let's get right down to the three of the major themes of a Charlie Brown Christmas.
One of the major themes is do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Well, that's one of the major themes of all the Charlie Brown shows.
Yeah, it is, right.
Charlie Brown's despair over materialism. Any thoughts about that? I mean, we sort of talked about that already.
What makes Charlie Brown so different from his peers?
That's a great question.
Why is Charlie Brown feeling all
that? And does anybody feel like Charlie Brown?
And not show it.
And not show it.
And they're just putting on a happy face because it's, you know.
Are there any children or adolescents today that sort of aren't comfortable with the norm and the way that the friends and families are sort of what they talk about and how they're living and but sort of just go with it because they're young.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I think for the younger they are, the harder it is to, you know, feel like Charlie Brown did because you're excited about the materialism.
There's something in me that almost always felt like Charlie Brown when it came to materialism.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I always wondered why people weren't asking the big important questions.
Yeah, and I think that it's easy. Here's what I I don't know if I'm getting ahead of you here with this, but the thing that I think always comes back around to bite us with materialism is how we are, and we end up so unsatisfied by it. So people have to have, you know, even adults for Christmas, their tree has to be perfect. They have to have this perfect pile of presents under the tree for their kids. They have to have the perfect Christmas feast, and everything just has to be just like on the commercials, right? And then when it doesn't exactly look like that in your home, it ruins Christmas.
Mm. Expectations.
There are dirty dishes. Somebody's got to do the cooking. Somebody's got to do the cleaning there, right?
I tell you what, when I was a kid, I loved the whole Christmas thing, including especially the gifts.
Yeah.
The anticipation of opening those gifts on Christmas morning was the most exciting thing in the world.
It really was. Yeah. That is not an understatement.
Yeah.
It's easy to say that, but oh my goodness, the anticipation of Christmas and then coming down and seeing that tree was just mind-blowing.
And all those gifts, and you got to finally open them.
Right.
It was so exciting.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess there's something to be said about children and Christmas and the whole Santa Claus thing. But I think it sort of breaks down when your intellect expands and your sense of time begins to shorten a little bit.
Well,
and you recognize that these things, they might fulfill for about, you know, a week. And you know that they won't fulfill for much longer than that.
I was just going to address that. Think, you mentioned a week.
Yeah.
Think about Christmas morning when you realized that you had already opened all your presents. That there was not
that's a downer.
Another present.
Yeah, that's a downer. However, when I started playing with my stuff, I was very excited.
You felt great.
Yeah, yeah.
But, again, there was an inkling. There was an experience of the limitations of materialism.
Yeah.
Because
even with children.
When you're plowing through these presents and there's more and there's more and there's more.
You got another one. And then another one. How exciting.
Right.
To
and
open
then
them.
All of a sudden, nope. Sorry.
That's it.
It's over.
That's it. No more?
There's you're a little then you start going back like you said you start going back to play with your presents which is great but just that sense at that moment when you realize that's it.
That's a good point. So Charlie Brown apparently transcended a lot of this because he knew that the materialism that the world around him that the culture around him was just completely fixated on was not enough. He knew that as a child.
Right. Well, he didn't have any hair. So
that's true. Well, he had one piece in the middle.
Yeah, he just had that little crop there. And so he probably had stared in the mirror a lot as a kid and thought, why me? And he, you know, all his peers had full heads of hair. And he probably asked himself some pretty profound questions as a little guy.
Ooh, that is an interesting hypothesis.
Yeah, because when you don't fit in with the mainstream culture, you start looking at yourself and going, what's up with me?
Yeah, and you get to pause and be a little more sober about things.
Right.
And you get to be introspective.
Yeah, you know, when you're very popular, you don't pause as much.
Kind of gets in the way of your mind.
Self-reflection, the unexamined life.
And reflection of the world.
Right,
right. All right, let's get to the second major theme of A Charlie Brown Christmas. And that is...
Not that one.
Why don't we get to the most profound, because I think... Did it happen before the Christmas tree? All right, let's get to the Christmas tree first, and then we'll do the line of speech. Charlie Brown's Christmas tree. What does it signify when Charlie Brown got it? And what does it signify after everybody decorated it? What is it? What is the theme here? The moral?
Well, I'm going to go in one direction with this.
All right.
I don't know if it's your direction. But to me, I'm going to use the word humble. It was a very humble tree.
Yeah, big time.
And Christmas is the humbling of the creator of the universe to the level of a baby boy born in a stable. He couldn't even get a decent room or a decent bed, and they put him in the feed box in the manger.
Yes.
How much more humble could you get? And when you look, when you watch the Charlie Brown Christmas episode and you see all these fancy fake trees, the metal trees, what were they, aluminum or something? I don't know what they were at that time. And they're just perfect, right? They're just shaped perfectly. They're painted perfectly. Mm. They just aesthetically perfect. But when someone bangs on one and it sounds like sort of like a gong, you start thinking that's not a Christmas tree, right? So what do they end up with? What is the perfect tree? This very humble tree.
Yes.
But what ended up making it beautiful was what? The fact that they took this very humble tree and showed it
after,
care.
After ridiculing Charlie Brown big time.
Yes.
Yeah.
And showed it care.
Yes.
And loved it.
Yes.
So you show love to the humble. I mean, we all see this. Like, there are these social media pages that all they do is they try to make you cry. And what is like a constant theme is some form or expression of humility.
Yeah.
Reaching out to the humble, right?
Yeah, actually, that's kind of what I had. That's when all you need to do in order to blossom is to love something.
Right.
Love is like sunshine to a flower, love to a person.
Right.
And they start off humble and maybe lack of self-esteem and confused, perhaps, and just a parent's love.
Despairing.
A friend's love, a spouse's love, if you're
a
that age.
A stranger's love.
Even a stranger's love.
Acts of kindness by a total stranger.
Child's love.
Immense.
It makes people blossom. It enables them to be who they are meant to be.
Right.
And that tree just blossomed when they gave it some love.
Yeah.
The other, perhaps most profound parts, main part of the Charlie Brown Christmas special was Linus's recitation of the Gospel of Luke. And this is right after Charlie Brown was just at his wit's end, saying, "Doesn't anybody understand the true meaning of Christmas? Is there anybody who can tell me?" And then all of a sudden, Linus says, "Charlie Brown, I can tell you the true meaning of Christmas." And he walks up to the stage, because the kids were trying to put on a play. He walks up to the stage with his towel,
blanket,
and he begins reciting the Gospel of Luke chapter 2, verses 8 through 14. And we might as well read them now, huh?
All right.
He said this, "And in that region there were shepherds out in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And an angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were filled with fear. And the angel said to them, 'Be not afraid, for behold, I bring you good news of great joy, which will come to all the people. For to you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, who is called Christ the Lord. And this will be a sign for you. You will find a babe wrapped in swaddling clothes and lying in a manger.' And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of heavenly hosts praising God, saying, 'Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace among men with whom he is pleased.'" So he recites this, and as soon as the line in, let's see, verse 10, where it says, "The angel said to him, 'Be not afraid,'" or "fear not," I don't know if you noticed this, but Linus drops his blanket. For the first time on any Peanuts episode ever, Linus drops his blanket. He's without his blanket then. And he continues to read the Gospel of Luke. But your thoughts on this poignant moment in Charlie Brown's Christmas?
You know, there's this incredible contrast between what they say, the glory of the Lord shone round about them. So you have the heavenly choir of angels. You have the glory of the Lord shining around the shepherds. Just think of how majestic and glorious and grand and, in the truest sense of the word, awesome, awe-inspiring that must have been. And they said, go see the baby. The contrast.
Transcendent? A transcendent moment that sort of unlocks the veil or wipes away the veil for these shepherds. And shepherds back in ancient Israel were considered the poorest of the poor.
Right.
And of course, the Gospel of
Unclean.
Luke. Yeah, the Gospel of Luke was very focused a lot on the poor and the needy. And so the shepherds were told of this, and you're right, from this glorious, majestic, transcendent moment, basically the angels are saying, go see the human baby who is right now in a manger in a feeding trough that is usually used to feed animals.
Who is the Lord?
Who is the Lord of the universe.
Right. So think about that. They say he's the Lord. The child that's born is the Lord. And man, would anyone on the planet have expected that the Lord?
Well, I don't think these shepherds would have. If these were just people that said, hey, the Lord is over there, he's a baby, they would have probably just laughed at him and continued.
Yeah.
But with such a majestic supernatural experience, the shepherds took it seriously, you would have.
But
too.
My point is not so much why did they listen. Just imagine, would the word be shock? What would the word be to describe their sense of when they see the Lord of the universe, their Lord, their Savior, that they had been waiting for from the beginning of the Jewish people's history, in a stable, in a manger, wrapped in swaddling clothes, not in a palace or even in a bed, in a feed box. That's what a manger is, feed box.
Speaking of humble Charlie Brown Christmas trees.
Yeah.
Wow. God humbling himself to be a mere part of his own creation.
Right.
To come down, be one of us.
Not in glory.
Relate to us as one of us, not in glory, so that he may save us from all the mess that we got ourselves into.
Right. And never, you know, there's this one scene called the Transfiguration where Jesus, as an adult, is up on a mountain and only Peter, James, and John see him in all his glory or in some experience of his glory. But throughout his earthly experience from the time of, you know, the babe born in Bethlehem to Calvary, even to his ascension, aside from the Transfiguration, his glory was never shown. He kept it under wraps. And here's the creator of the universe humbling himself to that extent.
Yeah.
And who among us is willing to do that? We're all very concerned about, what do we hear at jobs? Recognition. Right? I deserve recognition for what I've done. Now, this is the creator of the universe. And what recognition did he demand? He demanded nothing. He came as a peasant, and he spoke to us.
He just demands us to follow him and to obey him.
And you know what?
If you love me, you'll keep my commands.
The best, or one of the most striking descriptions of how Jesus communicates with us is the imperative invitation, which is kind of an oxymoron. Imperative means it's a command.
That's a good point.
But he doesn't hold us to it. He says, do this, don't do that. And then some people leave, and he does not stop them.
That's right.
That's humility, right? You have dictators throughout the world who say, do this, don't do that. And if you don't follow them, they chop your head off.
Right.
Right. The God of the universe let them walk away. And then he even turned to his own apostles and said, do you want to leave too?
Yeah. And this was right after the bread of life.
The bread of life. Right. Eat my flesh and drink my blood.
John chapter 6.
So the humility, you could almost say that was the prevailing characteristic of the earthly experience of Jesus that other people had, was his humility, right? I mean, they definitely experienced his authority, his power. They watched him work miracles. But even the apostles were frustrated with him. When are you going to establish your kingdom?
And why are you eating with tax collectors and sinners?
Exactly, and prostitutes.
And why are you talking to prostitutes and stray women that are asking you questions?
So here we have this materialistic culture where we want the BMW, want the McMansion, we want the vacation here and there, we want the money, we want the great big fat screen TVs, and et cetera, on and on and on and on. And the God of the universe who created it all had none of that. And yet, because he had none of that, because of his humility, and because obviously he had the words of eternal life, the world changed. Like you said, he initiated an entirely new global era. Yeah. It was never thoroughly pervasive, but Christianity is in every corner of the world today.
Yeah.
Because this very humble peasant 2,000 years ago had nothing, and all he did was spoke the truth.
No.
Well, a lot of miracles to go with it.
We would be remiss, of course, if we did not also mention that he was God.
Yeah, exactly.
he was divine.
But the point is, he didn't assert his divinity.
Right.
He didn't force his divinity on anyone.
He doesn't force, exactly.
He respects our free, he gives us free will.
Well, I mean, it would be, God is logos. He is reason. It would be unreasonable. It would be unreasonable and contradict his very nature to force us to love him.
It wouldn't be love. Love cannot be forced. Love is voluntary.
People and angels which are demons now, are in hell for all eternity, not because God wanted them there, or not because God didn't warn them 1,000 times, but because they belligerently, continuously said no to God.
Right.
Yeah. 978-454-4980 is our phone number. Beneath the Surface, talking about the Charlie Brown Christmas, believe it or not.
And all those souls that are in hell?
Yes.
Would not humble themselves.
That's right.
They would not be humble.
Exactly.
Like Charlie Brown's tree.
Like the tree. And like Charlie Brown himself.
Like Charlie Brown himself.
Charlie Brown never gave in.
He never gave in.
Yeah.
Right. But he never, what do you want to say? He never really won. He never really...
Never won.
Right. He never kicked that football.
Never. I'm thinking that's the first thing you go to is that football. And he never learns, too.
No.
Perhaps
he always gave people another chance. He's the Christ figure.
He may have been humble.
He always forgave.
He may have been humble and wise and forgiving, but sometimes he wasn't all that bright.
He suffered for it.
And he suffered
But you could
for
say
it.
The same thing about Christ. Why did he allow himself to be crucified? You could say that's not bright. But, of course, it was exactly the right thing to
do. Yeah. Well, Christ was certainly bright.
Yeah.
Charlie Brown may have been missing a screw now and then, but he was cool.
Yeah, he sure was. I'm going to get one of those shirts.
Let's talk about Rudolph, because there was a couple of interesting themes there, too. I want to get your take on it. Right. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
That Rudolph, okay.
Of course.
I wasn't sure which Rudolph you were talking
with
about.
With the snowman, the singing snowman, who was Burl Ives. You know. Looked exactly like Burl Ives in real life.
Sounded like him, too, didn't he?
Well, he was him.
Yeah.
In snowman form. Now, there are a couple of things to say about this. There's the loving misfits, and I'm talking about Rudolph himself, as well as the Island of Misfit Toys.
Yeah.
So both of those things. The theme of misfits feeling out of place, and I think a lot of kids and a lot of people in general feel that way, so people can relate to that. And the not-so-interesting theme, I think, was the fact that there was sort of an overriding utilitarian theme to Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. If you're not useful, you're not loved. You're not valuable. And I hate to say it, but I think that sort of bleeds through too.
Right. And why was Rudolph the hero in the end? Because he was useful.
Because he was useful.
Right.
Now, am I the only one that got that?
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason why the Misfit Toys are on an island.
Yeah, they're on a
utterly rejected. They're utterly abject.
Now, children finally began to love the Misfit Toys despite their misfit.
Right.
So that sort of...
their abnormalities.
That has a Christian theme to it.
Yeah.
But the only one who really loved Rudolph and totally accepted him and loved him anyway was Clarice.
Yeah.
his girlfriend.
Right.
The dog.
Well, you know, think about how many Christmas...
And maybe his mother.
How many Christmas stories
are
all about the great tragedy of Christmas if these presents don't get delivered? So, in other words, my kids think I'm just a crotchety old man because I say that, you know, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is not a Christmas story because it doesn't mention the birth of Christ. It has nothing to do with the birth of Christ.
Yeah.
It's all about presents. It's all about materialistic.
It is about presents, yeah.
It's a show about presents, right?
Mm. Well, let's go to that show to Frosty, the snowman.
Yeah.
Now, Frosty's interesting. For two reasons.
A little more complex.
Because there's a couple of Christian themes in this. Number one, Genesis 2, chapter 7, where God created man out of the clay of the ground and breathed into him and became a living being. Kind of reminds you of what magically happened from the creation of snow on the ground and the wind that came into this snowman that made him alive.
Well,
of course,
it was
the magic hat that did it.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, you have to use your imagination here.
Yeah.
So there was that sort of creation theme. And, of course, near the end, Frosty had melted because he I don't know what happened. I can't remember.
He sacrificed his life
to save
the little girl.
There you go. There's another Christian theme.
He said he would stay in the greenhouse.
And not only did he sacrifice his life for others, but he was resurrected at the end by another wind. You know, in Scripture, wind, breath, and spirit are all the same Hebrew word, ruah. That resurrected Frosty and made him alive again.
And you also have the sinister magician who he just wants the magic. He wants the power.
Yeah.
But he doesn't want the humility that goes with it.
Very interesting. It kind of parallels the world, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? And you, of course, have the Santa Claus figure who is like God the Father in the Frosty the Snowman episode because he sort of comes and saves the day when the hat is gone and Frosty's melted.
Yeah,
he comes back with his Christmas magic.
So he's the Father and Frosty is the Son who was resurrected after sacrificing his life for others. And the children are the people of the earth.
Us.
Very interesting.
And you don't have not all the people of the earth and Frosty the Snowman are welcoming to him.
But the children are innocents, and the children love him.
Right. And the adults don't really get it,
or
they're downright hostile.
It's amazing how children are so much more wise than adults sometimes.
You must become just like a child.
Just like a little child to enter the kingdom of God.
God.
Very good.
Yeah.
Let's... Let's think about the Grinch.
Yeah. The Grinch.
The Grinch seems to have a conversion repentance theme to it.
And love.
And love certainly triumphs at the end.
Right.
Yeah.
His heart grows, seven times that day or something like that? I forgot what it was.
It's a great poem. The whole thing is a poem.
It is.
And it's a great poem.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen it yet this year, and I look forward to seeing it before Christmas.
And by the way, I saw the Jim Carrey live action, and it's hilarious. I love Jim Carrey. He's so funny. But it is a departure from the original.
I thought it was good. I
enjoyed it thoroughly.
I didn't expect to like it as much as I did.
Yeah.
I still like the cartoon better, but I thought it was good.
It was good for different reasons.
Now, there's a third one that it just came out this year.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it.
No, it's out right now.
Yeah, it's out right now.
Yeah.
But any thoughts relating to The Grinch Who Stole Christmas?
The original animated one. Yeah, I think you have the Grinch character who, you know, it's ironic because he's an outcast, but he also despises Christmas, but it's because he sees it only as materialistic. So he decides that the way to destroy Christmas or to deprive them of Christmas is to take away the stuff.
Mm.
So he's mistaken about what Christmas is.
Mm.
And so he despises it.
The Who's knew what it was.
The Who's knew.
Yeah.
And they...
Including Cindy Lou Who is no greater than two.
You know what
no older than two, that is.
There's nothing wrong with Christmas gifts. So for us to say, watch out for the materialism of Christmas is not to say that Christmas gifts are bad. Mm. It's not. And you see it in the Grinch movie, or the Grinch original anime, is that the Who's knew the true meaning of Christmas.
Right.
And they enjoyed all the presents.
Absolutely.
If you understand it in the right context.
In the right context, prioritize properly.
Yeah.
The movie It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
With Jimmy Stewart.
Love that movie.
I see that as a metaphor for today.
Yeah.
In one aborted life. Now, there happen to be 65 million plus abortions since 1973. But just take one aborted life.
Yep.
If they were not aborted, how different
the world
would be.
Yeah. I also, changing gears a little bit
for
this movie, what it also shows is the hero of this show throughout life, which is what his major crisis in life was, that he never got to fulfill his dreams.
Yeah.
And look how much good he did because he sacrificed his dreams for the good of those around him who came around to save him because of how he saved them by sacrificing his dreams.
Yeah.
And we live in an era where nothing is more sacred than dreams.
Nothing is more sacred than dreams.
Follow your dreams. Don't give up on your dreams. Stay true to your dreams.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that Jimmy Stewart's character was born and the way that he changed the world. And
gave up on his dreams.
And I would just say, keep that metaphor in mind about our abortion age and how many lives have been lost and how the world is suffering and lacking as a result of that. There you go, Mr. Kent. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And I and Beneath the Surface itself will not be here in the studio for the next 4 weeks. We'll be traveling for the holidays. There will be Best of Beneath the Surface repeats. So Cindy will be here taking care of that. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Thank you for listening. I will be live here in a month from now, but keep listening every Monday evening from 10 to 11 Beneath the Surface, WCAP. Merry Christmas, everybody, and have a great new year.
BreadBox Media Programming is brought to you by...
It's so much more than just a profile picture. At Catholic Singles, our platform offers you many opportunities to get to know the person behind the picture. Sign up today at CatholicSingles.com.
Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at KaneFord.com.